You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places, in fact, to the very streets of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Biddy Mason Memorial Park on Spring Street in downtown Los Angeles is hidden. It's hidden behind a parking lot, an obscure place dedicated to a local icon that most Angelenos don't even know.
We don't know a lot about African-American history, and we don't know a lot about women's history.
Brenda Stevenson is a professor of history and African-American studies at UCLA.
We still have a narrative that's focused on white men. So there are gaps in our history, and Biddy Mason falls into some of those gaps.
So who was Biddy Mason? Why is there a park named after her? Well, she was an enslaved single mother of three, midwife, businesswoman, church founder, a city matriarch. Biddy Mason left an indelible mark on Los Angeles.
This is a person who was born a slave and is able to create something wonderful and lasting in one of the greatest cities in the world. And so her story needs to take a public space and public consciousness.
Today on Greater LA, part of our ongoing series on LA street names, we take up the story of one Los Angeles street that doesn't exist. Reporter Mike Schlitt asks, why not?
This is Cheryl Cox,
the great-great-great-great-granddaughter of Biddy Mason.
And this is Robin Cox,
the great-great-great-great-granddaughter of Biddy Mason. Yes, we're sisters.
We are at Biddy Mason's Park.
This is where her homestead was established after she moved to California.
On a wall in the park is a photograph of Biddy Mason.
It's the only known portrait of Biddy Mason.
It is an amazing photograph. I just can't stop looking at it.
She says everything with her eyes and her presence and her demeanor. You realize what type of woman she was, how strong she was, how powerful she was, and how she didn't take no for an answer.
Down in Mississippi, way down.
Biddy Mason was born in 1818, probably in Georgia. She was given as a wedding gift to Robert and Rebecca Smith, plantation owners in Mississippi. Biddy added to their family wealth by giving birth to three daughters, Ellen, Anne, and Harriet.
She was coming out of this institution that was meant to break you. She did what she needed to do to keep her family together.
She made herself invaluable, learning herbal medicines, skills as a midwife and a nurse.
She was a very important figure in the household, taking care of Robert Smith, the slave master's wife, because she was quite ill.
When Robert Smith converted to a new religion, Mormonism, he decided to move his family and all of his property out west. The journey was grueling.
She walked herding cattle, taking care of her own three children. They walked from Mississippi to Utah first, because they were Mormons. After leaving Utah, they eventually ended up in Southern California.
3 years later, in 1851, the Smith family, plus 14 enslaved people, arrived. Los Angeles was a frontier town, just about 1,600 people. Not a lot of them were black. But fortunately, historian Brenda Stevenson says,
Biddy Mason is able to connect herself with intelligent and well-off free African-Americans in California who inform her, guess what? You are in California now.
And California law says you are free.
Robert Smith, her quote-unquote owner at the time, getting wind to the fact that he's going to lose his slave property, has decided to move back to Texas, a slave state.
He hides Biddy Mason and the rest of his human chattel in the Santa Monica Mountains. But the friends of Biddy Mason fight back.
They go to the sheriff in San Bernardino County and say, look, this man is holding these people illegally, and he's about to steal them and take them back to Texas.
Biddy Mason and the others are sent to a Los Angeles jail for their own protection. The slaveholder Smith tries to get them back.
Robert Smith speaks to the sheriff and tells him, no, these people are part of my family. They want to stay with me. She and her children and then the others, they've all agreed to stay with me and to move into Texas. He was telling them at the same time that, you know, once they got to Texas, they would be free, which is just a bold-faced lie.
The judge, Benjamin Hayes, was a religious man.
And he wanted to get to the bottom of what was going on here.
State law didn't allow black people to testify in court, so Judge Hayes decided to question Biddy Mason outside the courtroom. He asked if she consented to the move. Biddy Mason told the judge she did not.
If the judge had ruled in Smith's favor, she could have been put to death. She was going to go out fighting for her freedom.
Then we get to the really miraculous part.
Perfect timing. 1 year later, in the infamous case of Dred Scott v. Sanford, the Supreme Court would rule that enslaved people, no matter what state they lived in, were property, not American citizens.
They have no rights the white man is bound to respect.
After Dred Scott, things would be different. But on this day, in this case, Biddy Mason sued for her freedom and won.
All of the said persons of color are entitled to their freedom and are free forever.
With her family's future secure, Biddy Mason went to work as a free woman in Los Angeles.
She was hired to work as a midwife and nurse.
She was able to serve both the white and the black community.
There were very few doctors in early Los Angeles, so that need allowed her to overcome that color line. Let's face it, when you're sick, you're going to seek help from who has the skills.
After 10 years, she'd saved up enough money to buy some land and build a family homestead.
Here on Spring Street, where we are today.
She did not read and write, so that's why they have an X that's on the wall. And that's how she signed her deeds.
She saved more money and bought more land.
Biddy owned everything between Spring and Broadway, between 3rd and 4th Street.
This was years before Los Angeles became a city.
She was the first black woman property owner in Los Angeles.
And as Los Angeles grew up around her homestead, Biddy Mason became
probably the wealthiest black woman west of the Mississippi.
So what did she do after she made her fortune?
Grandma Biddy had a saying,
if you hold your hand closed, nothing good can come in. For the open hand is blessed, for it gives in abundance even as it receives, which is actually a biblical principle. God will bless those to help others.
She felt the call to service, and she was always willing to step forward and to make herself a part of the solution.
She'd leave a tab open at the local market and allow people to come in and get what they need. She risked her life to treat the prisoners in the prisons when there was an epidemic.
The same prisons she and her family had been forced to live in years earlier.
Everybody in Los Angeles became her family. There weren't schools for black people to go to, so she knew that there needed to be schools. There wasn't a church for black people to worship in, so she knew that she needed to build a church.
In 1872, Biddy Mason led the founding of the first African Methodist Episcopal Church of Los Angeles.
And the church was formed in the living room of her home.
Jackie Broxton has been a member of First AME for 40 years.
The mission of First AME has always been first to serve. And that pretty much encapsulates Biddy Mason's whole take on life.
Good morning, First AME Church of Los Angeles.
Biddy Mason helped build First AME into a cornerstone of the local black community, and it remains so today. She died in 1891 after spending most of her life tending to the needs of the city. So now, how does the city tend to her memory in return?
Just the park. That's it. And the church. If you don't really understand your history, it's impossible to understand what's going on now. It's not right.
LA is full of commemorative spaces dedicated to wealthy power brokers and land barons. Wilshire Boulevard, Crenshaw Boulevard, streets named after William Mulholland, the two Isaacs, Lancashire and Van Nuys. But what about all the other people who built Los Angeles?
Well, I think that Biddy Mason, like most women in the 19th century, were not focused on leaving necessarily a public legacy that would live large in the imaginations of people in the future. It's always been important to reclaim the stories of people who have contributed mightily to our society.
For For Cheryl and Robin Cox, reclaiming the story is personal.
It has been ingrained in us that it was our responsibility to be the keepers of our family's legacy.
They're petitioning the city to name a street after Biddy Mason.
This is where her homestead was. We are hoping that with our petition, Los Angeles will rename Spring Street in her honor.
Can changing a name change public memory?
Spring Street would be perfect.
Brenda Stevenson thinks so.
If we are to shift our understanding of American history, that includes all of the people who have helped to build the United States of America, then we need to dedicate more public space to understanding what that history is.
Commemorating a past to construct a better future, that may sound pie in the sky, but if you want inspiration to do something that seems impossible, consider the story of Biddy Mason. Greater LA in Biddy Mason Park. I'm Mike Schlett.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places, in fact, to the very streets of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. You're heading north on Pacific Coast Highway. Ocean to your left, mountains to your right, sunshine everywhere. You pass a welcome sign that reads, Malibu, 21 miles of scenic beauty. But long before there was a Malibu sign, there was a gate, and people weren't welcome at all.
The gate was at Las Flores Canyon, about where Duke's restaurant is today.
Suzanne Gouldeman is a local writer, artist, and musician, and she says if you were traveling to Malibu 100 years ago,
you see a barricade and maybe even an armed cowboy, a vaquero there telling you you can't go any further. It's private property, and you were not getting through that barricade without an invitation.
Back then, Malibu was the private domain of one woman. Her name was Mae Ringe.
She rode her range with a revolver by her side at all times and had a horse named Dave.
She was a champion of land preservation, the scourge of squatters and railroad men. She fought the longest court battle in California history, and she lost it all in the end. But in a way, she also won. Here's reporter Mike Schlitt with the story.
You want to know how Malibu changed from an untouched paradise into a playground for surfers and celebrities? Well, that's a story that begins with love at first sight.
Mae was the oldest of 13. She grew up poor on a farm in Trenton, Michigan.
David K. Randall wrote a terrific book, The King and Queen of Malibu, the true story of the battle for paradise.
Mae really had the sense from the get-go that life is a struggle. You have to take what's yours and no one's going to give it to you.
Frederick was the only surviving member of a well-to-do family from Cambridge, Massachusetts. He saw the world as a beautiful place. It was there to be conquered.
They saw in each other what the other one was missing.
They met on her family's farm. He proposed. She accepted. They were married in less than a week. And not long after that, Mae and Frederick Ringe moved out to Southern California.
And LA itself is changing.
Thanks to Frederick and a handful of other Gilded Age men who invested old money in the new city.
So he became very wealthy very quickly.
But Frederick was looking for new worlds to conquer.
In 1892, Rancho Malibu Topanga Sequit was one of the last of Southern California's untouched Spanish ranchos. It had been uncontested Chumash land for centuries.
Kumaliwu is the Chumash village that gives Malibu its name. It's supposed to mean where the surf sounds.
The land was isolated, rugged, romantic, and wild.
It was also for sale.
It was available because it was so treacherous. You know, there were bears, there were snakes, there were mountain lions. You know, there were constant wildfires, constant mudslides.
Frederick and May bought Rancho Malibu for $133,000, or just over $4 million today. Their new neighbors, about 60 homesteaders living in the canyons above their estate, were settlers staking claims to government land.
You have incredibly rich people living next to incredibly poor people, and these natural tensions start boiling over.
What was everybody so tense about? Roads.
They were really isolated up there.
You think getting in and out of Malibu's headache today? Around the turn of the century, you had to hop on your mule and then go up and down these steep canyon trails. Or you could take a makeshift beach road, but it was only accessible at low tide. There was one other way, a private dirt road running through Frederick's property, pretty much exactly where PCH is today. Frederick let the homesteaders use his private road, but then...
Some lawyer tells him, if you continue to let people go through your land, that becomes a public easement.
So how do you stop a public easement?
You have to have some sign and it's private.
So Frederick put up gates, wedged between surf and rock, with keys just for his neighbors. And there were armed guards too, just in case.
The homesteaders hate this, because the wide open west that they still think they live in is suddenly becoming smaller and smaller. And it's also their lifeline.
The Battle of Malibu had officially begun.
They filed lawsuits. It was a bone of contention. It was fought for years.
Things were bad between the Ringes and their neighbors, and then they got worse. In the fall of 1905,
Frederick Hastings Ringe died suddenly.
He was just 47.
His widow, May Ringe, continued the tradition of keeping the world out.
With Frederick gone, May's enemies moved in for the kill.
The homesteaders laid in wait to try to kill her multiple times. They poisoned all of her livestock. She had to have armed guards patrolling Malibu and told them, you know, we don't fire warning shots here. It really was a kingdom to itself, and people tried to kill the queen.
The homesteaders weren't May's only problem. Southern Pacific Railroad wanted to build a coastal route from Santa Monica to Santa Barbara, a route that would cut right through May's land.
As soon as Frederick dies, they see a weakness and they try to move in.
But May had vowed never to let anyone take Malibu.
For May, it became a symbol of her love for Frederick. It became a symbol of her position as a woman in a world that didn't want to accept her. And it became a symbol of, I have all this money, why shouldn't I use it?
She decided to build her own railroad. A railroad to nowhere.
It's right on the beach and starts getting washed away very quickly. And the engineers come to her and say, you know, we need to fix this. We have to move it somewhere else. She said, no, just keep building it.
Had the grieving widow cracked?
Or did her lawyers find an obscure interstate commerce law
that said if one railway runs through the property, there can't be another one doing the same thing?
All it was meant to do was to keep the more powerful railroad companies from coming in.
And so Southern Pacific Railroad ran their new line through the San Fernando Valley. Instead of Malibu, the score, May Ringe 1, would be encroachers nothing. But the march of progress is relentless.
Johnny O'Connor bought an automobile.
For people whose entire lives have been dictated by train schedules, that you could go wherever you wanted in the car at whatever time, and you could be in this machine that could take you right along the coast through this beautiful land, and you didn't have to walk, and you didn't have to be on horseback.
In 1910, the Auto Club of Southern California was looking for ways to boost membership. They decided to stage a picnic on May's Malibu Ranch.
There was about 227 automobiles that attended and about 1,500 participants.
Morgan Yates is an archivist for the Auto Club of Southern California.
And they made their way to the Ringe Estate, and the gates were open and inviting in this instance.
Open and inviting? Why would May let the Auto Club have a picnic on her property now? She was a car enthusiast, but she must have seen the danger.
She defeated the railroad. Maybe she was feeling confident, you know. On the other hand, she lived to regret having that party.
the auto clubs really advocate for the building of roads.
And sure enough, when that picnic was over,
it was the first beach traffic jam in Malibu's history.
The floodgates had opened. There was no turning back.
There were all of these movers and shakers and important people at that picnic, and they felt like, well, everyone should be able to ride on this road.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. California.
The following year, state engineers start surveying May's land for an $18 million coastal highway running from Oregon to San Diego. May sues the state. The state sues her back, claiming eminent domain.
So eminent domain is the ability of the state to take land from a private landowner to be used for a better public purpose.
More suits and countersuits follow. L.A. County, the City of Venice, Santa Monica, the State of California, and the U.S. Department of the Interior. They all want to build a road on May's land. May's lawyers argue that a coastal highway through Malibu would serve no public purpose. The California State Supreme Court agrees. They rule against public roads. And it looks like May Ringe might defy the march of progress after all.
So eventually the case goes all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Government lawyers arguing before the highest authority in the land decide to try a new argument.
It was the only argument left. It was actually the most powerful one.
The argument goes like this. A road can take you from here to there, but that's not its only benefit.
It's also a way to transport yourself by exposing you to something beautiful. If you expose somebody to beautiful things, they're going to improve as a person.
The United States Supreme Court agreed. The court reimagined the whole notion of public good. And suddenly, all those things that made May Ringe fall in love with Malibu became the reason she had to share it with the world.
It was a kingdom away from everything else. And that was so enticing that legally they said that shouldn't be the dominion of just one person.
In 1929, the Malibu leg of the Roosevelt Highway, it won't be called Pacific Coast Highway for another 12 years, is finally open to the public. For May, it was a bitter defeat. Her fortune gone after decades in court, she had to sell off most of her Malibu kingdom. By the time she died in 1941, she'd lost everything. But in a sense, she also won.
If it wasn't for her, we wouldn't know Malibu as it is now.
May Ringe is the reason there's no marina in Malibu today, and no beachfront high rises either.
May Ringe has a posse. You know, her spirit's alive, and every ornery, determined person fighting to, you know, save what's special about this place.
And also, maybe May's spirit is actually kind of alive.
When I was on the book tour, this woman came up to me afterwards, and she's, you know, I grew up near Malibu. I saw May Ringe. On PCH, there was this elderly woman in rags with a rifle on the side of the road yelling at everybody. And it just seems so perfect that I don't know if it was true, but it was that same idea of almost like that she was haunting Malibu.
You may not believe in ghosts, but the next time falling rocks or mudslides close down PCH, you might ask yourself, is that Ringe's revenge? For KCRW on Pacific Coast Highway in Malibu, I'm Mike Schlitt.
That's going to do it for us on this special holiday episode of Greater LA. We're online always at kcrw.com/GLA. Subscribe to the podcast while you're there and get every episode of GLA delivered fresh to your feed. And share your thoughts with us, too, about your street in LA, perhaps, or something you want to hear on our show at kcrw.com/GreaterLA. By the way, Greater LA is Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Jackie Sudley, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Phil Richards, and Christian Bordall. I'm Steve Chiatakis, wishing you a wonderful new year. We'll talk to you in 2022.